You know, a little how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Before I got to these rooms, my mom and dad kindly asked me not to come around the house because of lying, cheating, stealing, all the same BS because of alcohol. And I had the opportunity to go home last week, and my dad had emergency surgery. And I was able to surprise him in the hospital, and when I went to the hospital room, he gave me a hug, and he wouldn't let go. And afterwards he said, "I knew you'd be here." You know, and the first thing I thought of was, thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you folks made me the son that I was supposed to be in the first place. And you know, it was an honor and a privilege to be of service for them for a week. You know, I wouldn't have done that on my own. That's because of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and doing these steps. There's that big part there, the 12 steps. So if you're new and you have those strained relations with your family, do the work and expect the results. Thanks for letting me share. The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are turned off and refrain from moving around or talking while the person is sharing. And to introduce the speaker. Well, since we're on the topic of that ninth step stuff, you know, it's an honor and a pleasure to see Doug do the work. And what happens is, it's great. When his mom and dad are in town, he takes them to meetings, follows them around, and you could see the smile in their eyes, the parents, of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for him. They love being around him and his friends. And that's because of the 12 steps. And today he's doing those living amends, and it's just neat to see. And if he didn't do the work, that wouldn't happen. And he's always in here in meetings. He's always being of service. And if you need something, he's there. And today it's an honor that I'm allowed to be called a friend. And it's a pleasure to introduce him, so please give him a warm welcome.
Hi, I'm Doug. I'm an alcoholic. It's by the grace of God, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 12 steps as they're written in the big book and explained by good sponsorship. I haven't had a drink since June 28, 2004. For that, I am eternally grateful. My parents were here tonight. They'd tell you that they are grateful. My brother and his family are grateful. The Orange County and Brevard County police and court systems are grateful. And I got a little letter here. I don't know if I'm supposed to share it. But it says, "Birds of a feather stay sober together." So, whoever made that for me, thank you very much. And I'd like to thank Brian for asking me to speak. I'd also like to let you know what my day was like today. It wasn't that big of a deal of a day, but I had some things go on. I woke up this morning, and I do like I always do after I, you know, brush my teeth, go to the bathroom, and all the manly things that you do. I turned on my TV, and no picture. You know, cable's out. So I call the cable company, and what? Oh, okay. Sorry. So I called the cable company, and they said it wouldn't be till Tuesday till they could get out there. Well, I didn't think too much of it because, you know, I needed that quiet time that it talks about in the big book. And I looked on my phone, and I had a text message from my friend Nancy letting me know that one of our friends from this group, Donna D., had passed away. Now, Donna had been sick for a while. It's not, you know, we knew that she was going to go to the big meeting in the sky. We just didn't know when. And last night about 12:30 was when it happened. But she's in a better place, and I'm, you know, just pray for her and her family. Ryan was telling you about my family. I always like to talk about my family because we're always close, but we were always strained. And the big strain was always me. And I never saw it that way, but today through working the steps, I can see it's that way now. But, you know, we talk about resentments here and, you know, how they are the number one killer. And I had resentments even before I was born. My parent, I'm the baby of three, and I played that baby to the very end. And I had an older sister that was 5 years old when she passed away. She was before I was born. And it was one of those things that I never knew what happened, how it happened. You know, it was one of those things that, you know, I just never questioned. You know, as I was growing up, and we would have our kindergarten pictures of me, second grade pictures of my brother, they'd have a picture of my sister in her tap dancing shoes. And then as I started playing sports, me and my brother, it'd be me in my football uniform, my brother in his football uniform, my sister in her tap dancing shoes. Graduation, me graduation, my brother, my sister in her tap dancing shoes. And it seemed to always bother me, but I was always afraid to question it. And my parents always talked about her. You know, she was all, you know, every Sunday we would go to the gravesite and, you know, we would, you know, look over and they would tell different stories. But I always felt left out because I didn't have any stories about her. So, you know, that's one of the parts where I felt left out. Another reason I felt left out is I grew up in a small Italian Catholic family, or a small Italian Catholic town. I'm not Italian, and my parents didn't bring me up Catholic. They brought me up Methodist. So another part of me feeling left out. Now, if you'd have looked on the outside, you wouldn't have thought it, because I had a lot of friends, you know, and I was very popular. But I felt I was popular because of my brother. I had an older brother who was very smart, straight A's, very personable. Everybody liked him. Girls flocked around him. And then there was me. And for me, I always had the, as my parents would say, an overbite. As people would say as I was growing up, buck teeth. Overbite does sound better. But I didn't get picked on a lot, but I still knew that, you know, this wasn't, you know, this wasn't good. And my parents put braces on my brother's teeth and they straightened out. For me, the dentist said, we'll straighten him out, but all he'll do is push him right back out with his tongue because he has what they called a tongue thrust. So I never got the braces and live with my teeth as they are. And I felt resentful against that. And my sponsor once told me, he said, "How old are you?" I said, "Well, at that time I was 48. "Well, you got a job, yeah. You have insurance, yeah. If your teeth bother you that much, why don't you go to the dentist and get them straightened out? It's no longer your parents' problem. It's yours." You know? Oh, yeah. So, you know, that was another big thing of me as my childhood that I felt different. But all in all, I had a good childhood. You know, my parents were always there. My mom stayed at home. Stay-at-home mom. My dad would work 3, sometimes 4 jobs to support the family. But my father was always there for me. He'd be there for every sports activity, any school activity, he would be there. My mom would be, when we were in grade school and we would have field trips, my mom would be the monitor to go on to field trips with us. Now, this would tell you that my family was close to me. Well, the way I looked at it, was that my mom was there to watch me. She's cramping my style. My dad's always there watching me play football just so the coach wouldn't do something that he didn't like. But that wasn't it. He was just watching his son. But I had all these strange things going into my mind. I don't remember my first drink, so that should disqualify me as an alcoholic right away, because I've heard people always say, "I remember my first drink." But I don't remember my first drink, but I'm sure it was by my father as he was watching TV, and I would be pestering him, saying, "Let me have a sip, let me have a sip." And I'm sure that's where I had my first drink. Don't remember my first words, but I'm sure they were mom, because I'm a mommy's boy. I was then, and I still am now. I don't remember my first sentence, but I'm sure my first complete sentence went something like, "You just don't understand. My situation is different." And I come in here, and I think everybody has that saying. Before I get started, I wanted to read something. It's in one of those hidden places in the family afterward. And it's on page 132. And it says, "So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of our past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered, and we have been given the power to help others." I wanted to read that because I'm going to tell you some things that I've done through my drinking. I'm not proud of them. I think, really, it's repulsive. I'm one of the worst type of alcoholics out there. I am a bar drinker. When I drink, I go to bars. I never drank at home. And of course, when you're a bar drinker, you have to get from one bar to the other. And I would drive. So I'm a drunk driver. And I'm going to tell you some stories about DUIs. And if you can relate to this, you're in the right place, because these people in here can help you. You know, and if it doesn't pertain to you, and if you know somebody that's going down this road, you know where to send them. But my first drink was when I was probably later in high school, probably about sophomore, junior. My brother, my first drunk. My brother was at college at Delaware. I'm from Ohio. Pennsylvania. Oh, well. I'm a Buckeye fan. But they went to pick him up at Delaware, and they said that they'd be home around midnight. And so I told my friends, I said, "Well, why don't you come over? We'll get some booze, and we'll get good and drunk." Because we knew what it was like to get a little bit of a buzz, but we wanted to get drunk. So they come over, and someone once told me, if you ever really want to get drunk, drink Mad Dog 2020. And I should have known better. My parents owned a liquor store, so I knew all the good stuff to drink, but Mad Dog 2020 was going to do it. So I got a bottle of Mad Dog 2020. My friends got a bottle of whatever they got. And the way I drink is when I get a jug of water, I'll drink the whole jug of water. If I have a soda, I drink the whole soda. So I had this Mad Dog 2020. I guess I have to drink the whole thing. I don't remember if I did or didn't. The only thing I remember was my friend saying, "We got to get him out of here. He's going to get sick." So they dragged me out of the house, and that was all I remembered until I got home. It was way past midnight. My parents were home. They met me at the door, and my mom looked at me, and she says, "Where were you?" And I said, "Well, I was downtown, just running around downtown." She looked at me, and she goes, "You got your dad's shoes on." And I said, "Well, they fit. My dad wears shoes two sizes bigger than me, but they fit that night." Now, here's something I never told my dad. They said, "You must have been running in mud." I want you to know that it wasn't mud that was on his shoes. I think I threw up that night. That was my first drunk. And when I woke up the next morning, my dad said, "How do you feel?" I said, "Man, I feel terrible." And he says, "You going to do it again?" I said, "Man, I'm never going to do that again." And I said, "Oh, okay, good. Now, my father thought I meant that I'd never drink again. What I meant is that I would never drink wine again. Because when I went to school that next Monday, they were telling me of all the great things I was doing around town. And, You know, all of a sudden, not only was I popular, I was, you know, the king of, I was almost the mayor of the town, you know. They were so happy, to, you know, of all the things I did. And so by that next weekend, I was ready to do it again, just not the wine. And then that started the whole process of me drinking. I got through high school, was looking for colleges to go to, and I had a friend that was a year older than me. They were going up to a college, Bowling Green in Ohio, and went up there for a weekend. And I was kind of looking for, you know, where I wanted to go. And when I got there, you know, they had keg parties and all this, and I wanted to go over to this bar. And in Ohio, you could drink 3-2 beer at 18. You had to be 21 to drink hard liquor. So I went into the bar, and I figured, well, I'm not going to be back here, you know. So I asked them for 7 and 7, you know, Seagram's 7 and 7 Up. And he served it to me. And I said, well, I just picked my college. And that's where I went to school for a year. And it only lasted a year because all of a sudden classes weren't important. You know, just drinking and going to the frat parties and just partying was more important. And I didn't think too much of it because my dad was making a good living, you know, working in that small town. And so I said, I'll just go home and work in that small town and make a happy living and live happily ever after. Well, you know, you live in a small town and you're doing crazy things and you have a family that's respected. You know, you kind of stand out a little. And, you know, it wasn't bad because people would say, well, that's just Doug. That's okay, that's just Doug. So it wasn't, you know, but after a while, it becomes a problem, and the cops would be bringing me home, or, you know, my parents would, you know, start saying, hey, you can't be living like this. And I said, well, why do I have to live in this small town? Why don't I just move? You know, the geographical cure. And I've never been to Florida, but I'd seen pictures. And I said, this is a place for me. You know, sunshine, no snow. You know, this is this past winter is probably the worst they've had, but I've had some bad ones when I was up there. And I said, Florida's a good place to come. So I come to Florida. And it was better than I could ever imagine. First thing is that you could drink and drive down here. You could have, when, this was in the 80s, you could have a bottle of beer and you could pass a cop and they wouldn't do a thing. As long as you weren't drunk, you could have beer and be driving. I thought, man, this is great. You know, in Ohio, you get thrown into jail. So I thought, man, that's great. You know, another thing, 18, you could drink anything. You know, I was kind of resentful because I was 21 at that time. But, you know, I thought, you know, if I could have only been here earlier, you know. And the other thing is that in Ohio, bars opened at 11 o'clock. Down here, they opened at 6. And they also had these things called bottle clubs that were open around the clock, you know, were 12 to 6. And I always had this dream for my vacation, little insanity before I really get into the insane things, is that I was going to start 6 in the morning and see how many days I could go around the clock, you know, hitting all these different bars and then hit the bottle clubs and then go around. See if I could do that, you know, see how many days I could drink. Thank God, you know, I got sidetracked before I was able to try to fulfill that. Then, I guess it was around 86 was when I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to group 3 DUIs all in one. When someone says something like 3 DUIs, there's going to be a lot of them. That's why I don't really You know, if you're like this, jump on board with me. But the first three, I didn't tell anybody. Nobody knew. My job didn't know. My parents didn't know. The only ones that knew were the court systems and my lawyers. And that was it. First one, I didn't have to come to AA. I went to the safety council, and they said, you have to go to one AA class. Well, I forgot about it. So as we were going into one of our classes, one of the girls that were in there said, we were talking about it. I said, oh, I forgot to go to the AA meeting. And I said, could I have yours, and I'll just copy it down. She said, sure. So the meeting that she went to was From the Heart. So I wrote down From the Heart, and then I signed it. Now, for the ones that are laughing or for the ones that aren't laughing, From the Heart is a woman's meeting. And so I wrote this down, and I filled it all out, and nothing was said. And I didn't know it until a few years later that, oh, From the Heart's a woman's meeting. Oh, okay. And when we were in there, they said, there was about 30 of us there, and they said, only two of you in this room are going to make it. The other ones are going to, you know, have another DUI, and then you're going to come back. Or should they said three of us. So I said, well, I know the girl that went to the meeting. She's going to make it. I know I'm going to make it. So I'm looking around the room to see who the other one is that's going to make it. Well, I don't know who the other one was, but I didn't make it. Because, like I said, I had to go again on my second one. And this time I had to go to an AA meeting. Went up to Rebo's. And I was working a night shift at this time, and so I went to their noon meeting. And I always felt that I ruined these guys' meeting because they all knew each other. They knew everything about each other, and here I come walking in. And it was like today when Brian asked if there's any newcomers. Well, they know I'm new, but I'm not going to raise my hand. You know, who's going to do that? So they went around the room, and then they started to share, like you're supposed to do, about your experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, one guy had four DUIs. Well, you know, I was on my second one at that time. Well, I have nothing in common with him. I'm not going to do this again. The next guy had his arm cut off because he fell asleep on the railroad tracks. Well, that's not going to happen to me. I never fell asleep on the railroad tracks. And, you know, they just kept on going over the things that they've done, you know, and I said, well, that's not me. And someone said, well, you just haven't had your yets yet. Oh, okay, whatever that means. And then I went along my merry way. And then, of course, the third one, and this is in Orange County. And then when the fourth one come, I ran out of friends to call to get me out of jail, you know, to bail me out. So I'm sitting in jail, thinking, what am I going to do? I know I've lost my job, so. So I called my mommy, because I'm a mommy's boy. And she calls my friend that's bailed me out before, and he come and got me, and my mom was there, and she says, don't worry, we'll get through this, it'll be okay. And of course, she thinks it's my first one, because I've never told him about the other three. And I said, Mom, you don't understand my favorite line. This is my fourth one, not my third. And if you ever want to see a mother break down, that was the time. She just lost it. But, you know, we got through it and come to AA, come to Central at that time. Read the steps on the wall. And then they kept on telling me, you know, you need to get a sponsor. So I read the steps on the wall. They said I needed to get a big book and read the big book. So I read the steps on the wall. And I thought that would be all that I needed, if I could just read the steps on the wall. At this time, they were sending me to counseling because the court system says it doesn't seem like... you know, you can help yourself. And it doesn't seem like you're doing the things that you need to be doing to be a productive member of society. So we're going to have you do things. So I went to counseling. And they seemed to always want to focus on my parents for some reason. I'm sure that I looked at it totally different than the way it really was. But they wanted to know my family dynamic. And so, you know, I could start pointing my fingers at my parents and my brother. You know, my brother was that perfect child. If I was more like my brother, maybe this wouldn't have happened to me. I lost my sister. And I could come up with all these rationalizations and justifications. And I don't think that's what it was about. I think they just wanted me to look at this stuff and then go from there. But I was looking at a way out to where I didn't have to look at myself. So I will group up the next two DUIs, which will be DUIs 5 and 6. These were over in Brevard County. Orange County had enough of me. So now I go over to Brevard County. Now, I always had this dream when I was over Brevard County going over the 528 bridge to where a cop would be following me. Why I would dream that a cop would be following me, I have no idea. But I'd be going up over the bridge, and then I would just go right up off of the bridge into the water. My first DUI over in Brevard County, 5th, I was going up the bridge, and there was a wreck. So we do as any normal person does. We turn around and look at the wreck. Well, for some reason, this cop jumped out in front of the road. So I thought. But what he was doing was directing traffic. So I get down at the bottom of the bridge, and the cop says, "You know, you almost hit a cop." And I said, "Well, we had a difference of opinion there, so, you know." I wasn't nothing bad. I just said, no, he's jumped out in front of me. So anyway, I got introduced to the Brevard County Jail. The 6th one, I was at the bottom, and I saw the lights come on, and I said I could gun it. And then for some reason, my car pulled over, and then I was hauled off again to the jail. And those two, I had to call my mother again to come get me or to bail me out. Now, she lives in Ohio. So can you imagine them being in Ohio, getting a phone call, and having to come down here, dropping everything that they were doing? And all I thought of is, this is what you're supposed to do. I'm your son. I didn't think anything of it. Again, I was in counseling, and my counselor said, "Do you have any remorse?" And after a while, yeah, you know, it was kind of bad of me, you know, the way I treated my parents. And that wasn't what she wanted. Now, all the other times I could finagle my way with counselors to find out what they wanted and, you know, comply with what they wanted, or so I thought. And this one, I didn't know what she wanted. And I was in a meeting one time, sitting back there by the water fountain, and this girl had a DUI, and she killed somebody. And she sat there and she told about how she killed somebody. And all of a sudden it hit me. My God, I could have killed somebody. And all of a sudden that remorse hit me. When she asked me, it says, "Do you have remorse?" I said, "Yes. I'm nothing but a dirty drunk that drinks and drives, and I have no thought of what happens to anybody else. No regard to anybody else on the roads other than me to get my next drink." So as I was coming to AA, I'd always come to the Saturday meetings, the noon meeting. And there's this guy that always read the doctor's opinion. And I was sitting there one day, and he says, "Doug, could you read the doctor's opinion?" And I hated to read. You know, I respect anyone that can come up here and read, you know, but I hated it. And the reason was, is I couldn't read that well. And So, you know, I stumbled and bumbled through the doctor's opinion. And when he was done, he explained what the doctor's opinion meant to him and what it meant and how it worked in his life. And again, that light bulb went off. My God, this is why you people keep telling me to get a sponsor. So when I read this stuff, there's somebody out there that can explain it to me, because I don't know what's going on here. So I went on my quest to look for a sponsor. And you know, what do they tell you when you're looking for a sponsor? Find somebody you relate to. Find somebody that has what you want. Well, the only thing that I could relate to was a drunk. That's not really who you want as a sponsor. Find somebody who has something that you want. Somebody with a nice car and a beautiful woman. You know, that's not what you're really looking for in a sponsor. But there's a guy in the rooms, real big husky guy, bald-headed guy, and when he shared, he would share from the heart. And he'd cry. And I know about these different cryings of when you're crying like me, oh, poor me, type deals. I knew about those. But this guy would cry, and when he would cry, it come from his heart. It was a cry of gratitude, of thank God that I'm not where I used to be. And I said, man, you know, that's the guy I need to be my sponsor. So I was out by the coffee bar waiting for him to come out. And, you know, it's like going on your first date, you know, asking the girl out, you know, will she say yes? Will she say no? What happens? So, you know, he comes out and I say, will you be my sponsor? And, well, yes, yes. He goes, are you willing to do anything to stay sober? And, well, yes, yes, I am. He said, okay. He goes, go home and pray. And read the doctor's opinion. And he says, for someone like you, he says, go to page 112 and read the first three words. So I go to page 112, and the first three words is, read this book. We can have fun with the big book. Another thing someone told me about the big book is that there's a misprint in the big book. And not many people know it, but it's in chapter 8. Chapter 8 is two wives. They spelt the word two wrong. It's T-O in the book. It should have been T-W-O. Because everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has two wives. I'm not married. That's the end of my jokes. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and we started to do the steps and run through a few of the steps real quick. The third step was probably, you know, one thing with me on the steps is that I didn't realize what the steps were until about three steps afterwards. You know, I am a little slow. When Lisa was reading some, you know, half measures and slowly, that's me. So when we did the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and then that little slash that our lives become unmanageable. Now, I should know, because my brother's an English teacher, that the slash means end of sentence, beginning of new sentence. I thought it meant that because I was powerless over alcohol, that is why my life is unmanageable. My life is unmanageable with or without alcohol. Because I would go periods without drinking, but my life was still a wreck. If you'd have followed me at the times when I wasn't drinking, you'd say, who is managing that guy's life? It must be some crazy person. And I thought it was just totally natural. You know, I thought nothing's wrong there. Step two, I didn't like the word sanity. It meant I was insane. And someone explained to me that doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, is a form of insanity. Six DUIs expecting a different result is insane. So they kind of convinced me of that one. Then the third step prayer, I would go over to my sponsor's house. And he's a pretty popular guy. People would be coming in and out of his house, you know, a lot. And we were on the front porch where we would do a lot of our step work. And he said, "Are you ready to do the third step prayer?" And I said, "Yeah." So I figure we're going to go into the room, find a nice corner somewhere where nobody's going to be around or break in, no windows, and do the third step prayer. Well, he gets down on his knees right on his front porch. So I follow suit, get on his knees. He holds his hands out. Well, I hold my hands out. He grabs a hold of them. And I'm thinking, looking over my shoulder, I sure hope nobody comes walking in. And we do the third step prayer. And after we were done, he said, "Do you know what you just did?" And I, "Well, yeah, I did the third step prayer. You know, gave my will and my life over to the power of God." He says, "Okay." And he says, "How do you feel?" And I said, "Well, I have a couple conflicting feelings here." I said, "I feel rather embarrassed that we did the third step prayer on your porch." I said, "But then again, I feel rather relieved that nobody come by." So, and about 2 days later, I gave him a call from work telling him how bad they're treating me at work, that this is going on, that this is going on. And he said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. Didn't you do the third step prayer?" He said, "Yeah. Didn't you tell me you understood what this third step prayer meant?" I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Well, then it's none of your business." So that from then on, I realized that none of this stuff that's going on around me is any of my business. It makes life a lot easier when I do it. And the word is when I do it. Because I don't do it all the time. I still want to get my fingers involved into it. Now, my fourth step, my sponsor always likes when I bring up my fourth step. Now, in the big book, see, I got a big, big, big book. I call this the over 50 book. My sponsor says, "You need a book like that, Doug, because it has big print. And we want to make sure that you read the big print." And the fourth step, it tells you exactly how to do it. You know, it has, you could probably even see that in the back there, can't you? Exactly how you do the fourth step. So after about 4 or 5 weeks of procrastinating on the fourth step, he finally says, "Sunday, we're going to do the fourth step. You ready?" I said, "I'm ready." So I go up to him. He says, "Let me see your fourth step." I hand him this. He says, "What's that?" I said, "It's my fourth step." He said, "Let me look at it." He looked at it and he says, "Mom, dad, brother, job?" He says, "What kind of fourth step's that?" And he threw it back at me. He says, "Go home, get the big book," and he says, "Do it like it's in the big book and I'll see you next week." So I couldn't get anything past him. As we said, half measures availed us nothing. So I did it as it was in the big book. And the fifth step, if I thought the third step was bad, the fifth step was even worse because we went down to the park down there at Langford Park. And now we were in the midst of nature. I didn't realize how important this was until after, of course. So we get down on our knees in the middle of the park, people walking by, again holding hands, doing the third step prayer. And then him asking God to help me be as honest and thorough as I can, and asking God to, you know, help him be a good listener and do what he needs to do. So I get up, and I would like to tell you that I told him my fifth step, but what we did is we shared our fifth step. Because if it was just left to me to do what I had, you know, just to tell my side, I wouldn't have. You know I would have held back. But I would tell a little bit, he would tell a little bit. I would tell a little bit more, he would tell something a little bit more sicker. Made me feel comfortable to tell him a little bit. And before it was over, I was cleared. And he says, are you holding anything back? He says, what's the thing that you are going to keep, take to your grave? And truthfully, what I was going to take to my grave was my DUIs. I did not want anyone to know about that. And, you know, some people have different things. Some, you know, that was my big thing. Other people have others. Steps 6 and 7 are real small in the big book, but they're probably one of the most powerful two steps, you know, that we have. I always, when I sponsor people, I always go through the 12 and 12 with it on the 6 and 7. But, you know, defects of characters, you know, I had a lot of them. In this little pad, he had me read things in As Bill Sees It. And one of the very first thing he told me to read was on defects of character. He knew that before he even really knew me. He knew of my defects of character. And I want to get to my 9-step amends that Brian was talking about. As I said, I put my parents through a lot. And if you'd have asked them, they would have said, oh, no, Doug was a real good boy. Doug was just a fine boy. And then my mom started to twist it up a little. She said, Doug was a real good boy. It's when he became an adult that he was really bad. It's when I grew up. And that's when the problems started for her. But, you know, and I often wonder, you know, when we were getting ready to make the amends, you know, I told my sponsor, I said, okay, I'm ready to go to my parents. I'm going to go tell them, you know, how wrong I was and, you know, how I knew I did them wrong. He said, wait a minute. He said, what are you going to tell them? You're sorry? How many times have you told them that you were sorry and then had to call them from jail and say, hey, can you come and get me again? And so I said, oh, okay. He says, let's take care of these other amends. Let's take care of your old boss. Let's take care of your work. Let's take care of these financial things. We'll get to your parents. So I was about 2 years, 3 years sober, and I probably made amends to my parents. You know, they were just happy that I was sober. You know, they were happy that I wasn't drinking, and I had friends that weren't drinking. And my father was going to have hip replacement. So I called my sponsor, and I said, my dad's going to have hip replacement. I think I'll surprise him and go up and visit him. And he says, good. He goes, it's about time that you go up there and do something for your parents. So I, like Brian, I didn't tell my parents. I just went up. By this time, I was able to drive and even get rental cars and be insured and all that good stuff. And so I went up, and it was in the middle of winter. And I've always said I will never go back to Ohio in the winter. And I bet there was 2 inches of snow, and here I am driving in it thinking, my God. You know, before I left, my sponsor said, he goes, be open for new experiences. So as I'm driving down in that snow, I'm thinking, ah, yeah, this is my new experience, driving in snow again. Okay. So I go get home, and I call my parents, and I'm talking to them, and as I'm walking up, I'm knocking on their front door. And my mom's by the window, and she's hollering at my dad. There's some fat guy walking down our sidewalk. And I'm on the phone, and I'm saying, Mom, it's me. So I get there, and, you know, they were surprised, to say the least. And my dad, of course, well, what are you doing here? I said, well, I want to see you get through the operation. And so I was there for a week, and my dad went in for the operation. And it was supposed to be a 2 hours, and it ended up being 4 hours. And my mom was a wreck. And as the doctor finally came out, and he said, it'll be a few hours before he's able to see visitors. He said, so, you know, go out and get something to eat and come back. So we're walking down the hallway, and I'm walking with my mom. My brother's a little bit ahead of us, and my mom grabs me, and she says, I don't want to go get anything to eat. She goes, I don't want to leave. And I said, why? It's going to be a couple hours. And he says, well, when your sister was in the hospital, they told us to go get a bite to eat. And we went out to eat. And when we come back, they told us that she died. He says, I don't want to leave. I said, okay, we won't leave. And I often wondered why my mom would share that with me and not my brother. And I realized that it wasn't me. It was because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding. And before I left, my brother come up to me and he says, I want to thank you for coming up here. He says, I don't think I'd be able to do this without you. And I realized what my sponsor was saying. You know, the new experience was being there for my mom and being there for my brother. I thought I was just being there for my father. A couple years after that, my dad was down here visiting. My mom was up home. She went to the doctor and was diagnosed with cancer. So I come home from work and my dad's crying. He says, Mom has cancer. I'm getting on the plane and I'm going to go back home. I said, okay. And when she was getting ready to go in for her operation, I went up there to be with her. This time I told him I was coming home. And when I was up there, my mom, kind of emotional. When my dad was here, I called my sponsor and said, my dad's getting ready to leave because my mom has cancer. Now, one guy had a date with somebody. Another guy had a job, just started a new job. Another guy had a big meeting the next day. And the other guy had a big exam at school. And they dropped everything to go out and eat with my father, to be with him and support him. And it made me realize that this is what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. You know, it's not just about us helping each other getting sober, but it's being there for the family members also. And, so we called my mom, and she got all choked up. And she says, Doug, these are the best friends you could ever have, these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, we'll jump down to the 12th step. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we carry this message to other alcoholics. As I would sit in the back and read the steps, I didn't know what the spiritual awakening was. You know, what is that? You know, am I going to see the white light like Bill did, or what? But what it is it's just a change of thinking. It's the change of thinking of Doug, who when he was down here and his dad called him and says, I had a heart attack, I just wanted you to know. No, don't worry about it. And for me to tell him, what can I do, Dad? I'm down here. You're up there. Sorry. Hang up and then go out and drink. From being there to being able to be up there and support him when he's going through his operation. And carrying the message to another alcoholic, sponsoring people, being there for the new person, reaching your hand out, you know, opening the doors, just being there. And before I leave, I'd like to read my football story. It's from Diz T. He's from North Florida, or at least that's who I heard it from. And it's, Alcoholics Anonymous is going to have a football team, and you're going to be the quarterback. We're going to give you two ends named patience and tolerance. We're going to give you two tackles named honesty and humility, and they can block anybody. We're going to give you two guards named unselfishness and gratitude. The center's name is willingness. We suggest you use willingness on every play. The running backs are belief and faith. You can hand the ball off to either one of them. Your wide receiver is going to be courage. You can throw the ball to him if you want to. God is going to be the only official. The ground rules are going to be the 12 steps. The football is your eternal soul, and the goalposts are your gates to heaven. Now get out there and play ball. Thank you very much.